we're back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel in a turtleneck today, which you can't hear, but you will intuit throughout the broadcast.
And also intuit that I, Aida Osman, am also wearing a turtleneck. Ira, what's good? Where's yours?
Yeah, we have a lot of sinister energy going on here, mm-hmm. And Ira's wearing just a t-shirt. It really feels underdone.
I don't participate in iPhone PowerPoint culture.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Girl, elaborate.
Not really.
Elaborate.
Turtlenecks, like Steve Jobs.
Oh, here we go. Okay, I'm with it now. That's a nice. See? Thanks. Below the belt.
Thank you.
You're already making me want to jump into my Keep It, which is Aaron Sorkin related, but I'll let the viewers guess what that's about.
I could have guessed that would have been your Keep It, Louis. It's very on brand for you.
Mm-hmm. Having interests and concerns, yes.
Yes, with something that we know very little about.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
He teaches. He teach and he protect.
Constantly Clytemnestra over here.
Mm. But does she kill her kids?
No, that was Medea.
Right. Who did Clytemnestra kill? Like her husband?
Agamemnon,
what? That's right.
What play are we talking about?
We're talking about Agamemnon.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you did answer before.
From the House of Atreus. Although I think I meant to say Desdemona? No, that's Shakespeare.
Right.
Where's my brain this morning?
Clytemnestra was evil. She was like a sorceress.
Yes, but I meant like, who was the seer?
Oh, that's a good question.
Cassandra.
Cassandra, that's it.
Yes!
Look, here I am.
Cassandra.
Girl, I thought when you said Medea, you was talking about those plays. I'm not out of this conversation. I said, we're not talking about Tyler Perry this early in the morning. Okay, guys, I will read Agamemnon and report back with this nonsensical information.
I took one acting class in college, and we had to read at least a little bit of that or something. But I had a very frightening acting teacher who was in her late 60s, and her name was, of course, Meredith. And she, in the past, had played Clytemnestra, and when people have that power, they scare you. It is a scary thing to be able to play someone like that.
Mm.
We'll get, actually, in terms of scary performances, we'll tap into that with our interview today. But
so remember last week when Louis said it was a slow news week? Now, Armie Hammer's drinking blood. What's up with that?
Oh my God. What a great question. Well, I'll tell you this. So the story is that he's allegedly DM some people, and there's some fetish verbiage about drinking people's blood. Can I just say something?
Standard.
Rich people are bored.
Yes.
And I think many fetishes in this realm that are kind of like, I'm saying something utterly twisted, really comes from being fucking bored and having a bit too much money.
You're like a 6'4 attractive white man who with a wonderful jawline, and you've played yourself twice in a movie. Like, the amount of ego and narcissism that it entails, I feel like at a certain point, just like, yeah, I have to eat human flesh to get hard.
Like, I thought that rich white people drank blood anyway. Elizabeth Bathory, I thought that was just the thing.
Oh, you thought that was a documentary, yeah.
Well, you know, also, like, doesn't he own an island?
Well, they own a whole bunch of stuff, like the Hammers.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just like, they could have all sorts of people, poor people, on that island that they hunt for sport and drink their blood. I just assume that's what the Hammers did.
In fact, that's why he's called that. Armies are his favorite food.
Oh.
Yuck.
But basically, this is a story that is far too confusing to even get into, mostly because every time there are leaks of Armie Hammer on some sort of social media site or dating app talking to a woman about his fetishes, and then we see his likes on Twitter that are just sort of like ropes and whips and S&M stuff. We've established that he's into that.
Yeah.
But I'm always confused whenever one of these sort of messages leaks, because for me, the question is, what kind of person are you who knows that your divorce is sort of high profile, and every time you have a conversation with a woman, like, she is going to probably screenshot it and share it.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you keep doing it is my question. You know, like, find some other means to attract women.
Girl, get guess, a make a fake account. Point. Get a WhatsApp. Like, why are you constantly self-sabotaging? And also, I think that...
With your name there.
Yeah, what really scared me about this whole story was that the way that the person was speaking, because, I mean, now the person who's released a lot of these messages has doubled back and been like, it was fake. Like, I promise you, it was fake. Even the audio that I have is fake. But... All of the messages are written in the same voice, are written in the same, like, overly perverted, and I'm going to be extra detailed about it because I'm getting off on this. It's all suspect, and I unfortunately believe it's real. I really do.
Mm-hmm. And whether it's real or not, you know, there's also that question of, you know, if you're into bondage, S&M, mm-hmm. et cetera, you know, choking people, there's consent in that, you know, and... You know, you should address it with a partner in a safe way. You know, probably mm-hmm. don't just sidle on up to people and say, hey, can I choke you?
Yeah.
Can I drink your blood? You know, that is sort of the same sensation I get when someone sends me a hole pic on Grindr for the first message.
Good morning.
I didn't ask for that. I'm sitting here watching cartoons.
Is that what you're watching? All right.
Yeah.
I actually got really stoned this weekend and watched Laser Wolf on Adult Swim.
How is that? I've been meaning to get around to that show.
I actually quite enjoy it. A friend of mine, Nikki, writes on it, and Quinta is also a voice on it.
Yeah, isn't Vince Staples is a voice on it too? It's like, yes. It's a show that's literally made for me. It's made for Aida. And I've yet to watch it.
I don't really watch cartoons that much. I was trying to get in the headspace of people who get stoned just to watch cartoons. It's kind of fun.
Girl, you guys are going to stop calling animated distinguished television cartoons, okay? This is not Looney Tunes.
Okay.
This is, no. there's narrative. There's plot. And I know you saw it.
I apologize.
Thank you.
American anime.
Thank you. Thank you.
I will say, these details about Armie Hammer would have been critical in making his character in Rebecca fantastic. Unfortunately, they gave him no coloring of the sort. So I'm now led to believe Rebecca was even more of a missed opportunity. Because that character should be perverse.
Yeah. I guess to wrap this up, when you hear a story about this where there potentially may be a celebrity who is abusive or at least coercive in some of their language, we talked about this a bit the other week with Shia LaBeouf, right?
Yeah.
It took so long for us to depart from Shia LaBeouf because we were enraptured by his acting and sort of all the weirdness surrounding him. Fortunately, there's nothing in Armie Hammer's acting catalog to enrapture us. And if it turned out that we had to stop thinking about Armie Hammer tomorrow, I could do that.
I do think it's possible.
Well, yeah, but you're going to have to get through because he is doing a sequel of Silence of the Lambs called Silence of the Kittens. So just
prepare for that.
But
oh,
beyond
God.
Beyond that.
Aida's on the fucking match game this week.
After he receives his Oscar for that. Armie Hammer Lecter. Okay, we can end the intro.
You did it, yeah.
Anyway, we've got a lot of news to get to this week. There was a coup at the fucking Capitol, and Trump's off Twitter. We'll discuss all that and more. Plus, our guest this week is the fantastic Riz Ahmed, and we're going to talk about his amazing new movie, Sound of Metal. We'll be right back. Hey. There's new Keep It merch in the Crooked Store. Check out the We Can't Cancel You If You Were Never Scheduled sweatshirt, which is also the image from the first month on our calendar. So you should definitely get that. There's also a Je Suis Catherine Deneuve mug, which is perfect for sipping and spilling the tea. I didn't write that copy. Anyway, shop now at crooked.com/store. I feel like it was truly days ago that we were talking about a bad Vogue cover.
Every time there is a Vogue cover in the United States, we have a conversation about it.
And speaking of having that conversation.
Sure.
This week, we're talking about Kamala Harris on the cover of Vogue. which I'm very happy for. You know, I'm excited for her to have a Vogue cover.
Girl, that was not a Vogue cover. That was a behind-the-scenes shot of an Old Navy commercial. That was not no Vogue cover. No.
I wish that it were any other country but U.S. Mm-mm. Vogue, mm-mm. because their covers are awful and usually unimaginative. Maybe the last one I enjoyed was, well, Harry Styles. That was a good one.
The Beyonce, there was a Beyonce cover that was amazing.
Yes, which is even wilder because Tyler Mitchell, who shot Kamala Harris for this cover of Vogue, shot both of those covers.
So we know that the range is there. And we know it. And I don't even blame, I don't blame, of course, I don't blame Tyler Mitchell for the horrible photo that was chosen for Kamala Harris's Vogue shoot. But girl, a lot of slacking happened.
No, just to be clear. So wait, when you're talking about the horrible choices, you mean the first one that was like pink and green, right?
Yeah. The one that, was like the colorway was Trader Joe's mochi. Like it was not, something was wrong.
Well, it was the AKA colors.
Yeah. Okay. I do appreciate the colors.
The pink and green, which when I was talking about how I did not like this cover, I want to give a shout out to the very helpful white gay man who DM'd me and told me that those were the AKA colors because I would have had no idea otherwise.
Yeah, because there's really no
no way of knowing, even though I was raised with AKAs being the enemy because my mom was a Delta.
Oh, so you have history. Yeah. You have history. But I was going to say, it's really only a nod if I can see you nodding. You feel me? Like,
yes. Well, she wasn't nodding. She was more holding her hands.
To me, there was something particularly odd about how far away she was, like how much of her, like we could just look at her shoes. Yeah, it was not right. Mm. But green and pink, I knew that. I knew it was an AKA coloring thing. But it also just reminds me of the movie Young Adult, which fills me with a sort of, because she wears the green sweats and the pink sweatpants. And it just fills me with dread because that character is on the brink.
This cover that we're talking about sort of leaked online earlier this week. It was just appeared on Twitter, and everyone was sort of wondering, is this a fake cover? Because it looks so god awful.
It was a scary picture.
It's a scary picture. She's wearing the Converse, which I guess is part of her brand now.
It's a brand
and
deal,
Tim's. Yeah. Converse and Timberland are battling for the soul of our nation.
What's next? She's gonna do it.
What's
Fubu
happening.
And Peli Peli next. Just wait.
The endorsements that she is going to walk out of the White House with, I am so jealous.
I'm excited for her.
But she is standing like almost in this field. There's a pink curtain hanging behind her, and it just looks like you are in a studio at Kmart, or it is like your roommate just started taking headshots and he wants to do some test photos on you.
Yes.
She's also completely washed out. Mm-hmm. She's a light-skinned woman, but they made her look like Lewis.
One of the lightest skinned women I know. Yeah.
It looks like the photo that they took to make sure the memory card was in. Like, I don't think that it was one that was intended to be printed. It was an outtake that they put as a front photo.
The one they ended up choosing, do we like that one better? Because I will say, the color of the suit she's wearing, gorgeous, that kind of powder blue or whatever. Mm-hmm. The thing she's standing in front of looks a little bit like a massage table to me. And the coloring of the curtains behind her, to me, read Carson Tonight Show or Muppet Show. So it's not like we got a triumphant solution, I thought.
Yeah, I like the second photo that Tyler Mitchell shared on his Instagram.
That one was fantastic.
Just a shot of her in front of a gold curtain. That one actually looks pretty glamorous. The one before, I love the suit. And I love the coloring, but yes, the massage table behind her, I don't know what's happening.
Even in that photo, which is supposed to be the better one, the one that Tyler posted in the thread, the second one, it's lit differently and it flatters her in a much more like domineering in a respectful way. The other photo kind of just ages her. The one they use for the cover makes her look much older. It's not very sophisticated, I feel like. And this is just like one of the many failures, I think, from the Vogue team to pick the right photo for black women.
Yeah, this looks like she is in Star Wars. I don't know. Like the colors are a little Naboo. But Tyler shared this cover on Instagram, not the other one.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
So, Anna Wintour, what's good?
Exactly.
What is the thing that just keeps U.S. Vogue covers from looking so uneventful? I know that they're celebrity-driven, but when you look at one, like, there's no imagination to them, and they're very much covers that I guess if you're in the aisle at Walgreens or Gelson's or Piggly Wiggly, you will recognize a celebrity and grab it, right? But gone are what you would sort of, like, imagine why people get into the fashion industry. Like a dazzling cover.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing fashionable about this cover.
I think about a Rihanna Vogue cover that she did for UK that is just so stunning. It looks like album artwork. It's beautiful. And I wonder if a lot of the US covers have kind of diminished in their decadence or whatever because Americans prefer approachability and they don't necessarily enjoy the high glamour. But Anna Wintour in U.S. Vogue is out of chances with me. Like these covers from Simone Biles and that horrible Annie Leibovitz, you know, spread that we saw. We talked about really recently where she just looks ashier than all get out. And I know that. I know Simone keeps it moisturized. So I know that's not the case. And Michelle Obama Vogue shoots that have happened during Obama's presidency, they were all poorly lit as well. Like there's just failure. It's failure.
She had three covers that, you know, like in retrospect, when you watch them, they're sort of pitiful.
Mm-hmm.
Was she just laying on a couch on one of them or like sitting on the edge of like a couch? It's there's no vision to them, really. They look like press photos for a ABC primetime drama. You know,
like Madam Secretary understudy.
Not even that. They look like One Life to Live cast photos, okay?
I do think you put your finger on something, Aida, which is the problem is celebrities need to be less approachable again. I miss when they were just untouchable. We didn't know shit about them on Twitter. They kind of seem mean. Like, again, I'm going to bring up Madonna again.
The diva era. Bring it back.
You think Madonna cared about her fans in the 80s? Absolutely not. And you did not approach her, and she was frightening. And that's the way we liked it.
I prefer it.
Yeah, I just can't imagine anyone wanting to get into the magazine industry or work at Vogue from seeing any of these covers. You know? Like there's no magic.
Girl,
there.
I look better in this Zoom call right now. The lighting in my room is better. I think, and this is the important thing about this story is because it feels so insignificant. Like, when I first saw it, I was like, who cares? Kamala doesn't care, whatever. But Vogue, like, undercut Kamala's team and used a photo that she didn't approve on. And also, a lot of people are going to see this, and we know that American politics is about pop culture and about your image. And if you are continuing to undercut one of the first big images of Kamala Harris, like that's problematic, and that makes it difficult for her to like establish likability. I mean, I've seen her dance, so a lot of likability is gone already. But I'm happy that Kamala is here, and I just want her to have a fresh slate. And this didn't do much justice.
She really does dance like she is jumping for mushrooms in Super Mario World, doesn't she?
She really does be booping around. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
But now, speaking of Vogue contributors, I don't know if you guys caught the new Martin Scorsese-directed Netflix show, Pretend It's a City, which is just following around resident New York City wit Fran Lebowitz as she talks about everything from pedestrians on the streets of New York, which honestly is incredibly boring. I think they should cut out every observation of hers that like a comic strip from the 80s could have made.
You have to dig deep to get the great stuff. The first episode is a lot of people use cell phones. Isn't that crazy? I don't have one.
Oh. Right. No, it's like, no, I know what stand up from 1991 sounds like. You don't have to reiterate that to me. But this is like a queer woman who's one of these like New York people who wears a uniform, like has a particular blazer, a shirt, a pair of jeans, you know, like Michael Kors or somebody, like a real fixture in New York type. And when she gets into things like knowing famous musicians in New York, knowing Andy Warhol or Charles Mingus, that's when it gets interesting and it becomes less about relatable foibles of humankind and more about, here's what excellence is. Let me tell you my definition thereof. And I think it's a lot of fun to watch. I will say, if you haven't seen Public Speaking, which was Martin Scorsese's sort of first thing about her from 10 years ago for HBO, which is literally the same thing, him and Fran Lebowitz hanging out and him laughing at everything she says. That one is better. It's just 90 minutes, and it's her talking about things like how AIDS wiped out like a generation of amazing connoisseurship. Like, the people who died of AIDS were the ones who would go to the ballet and be like, Suzanne Farrell can't keep her leg up. I think she may as well kill herself. And she talks about how the audience is just as important as the performers. But I will say, Fran Lebowitz, for me, goes down real easy. I watched like 7 episodes of this, and it felt like it took 15 minutes. So I recommend it.
Oh, wow.
She's great. And I like that a lot of people were sort of discovering Fran with Netflix,
yeah,
to be honest. You know, like as a name that they sort of knew. I was obviously familiar with Fran Lebowitz, but I wasn't like, I'm sure, a stan, you know? So it was nice to sit down and just sort of take it in. Plus, I love when Marty is just like having a fucking good time.
Yeah.
Marty Scorsese sitting there is just cracking up at everything she says. And it's like, that is the best Marty. Like, I love his Instagram too.
Yeah. But like, and also I had forgotten, like, he had put her in a minor role in The Wolf of Wall Street. Like, you see Fran here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Also, something I want to say in appreciation of Fran Lebowitz is she's somebody who put out 2 books in the late 70s that were about New York called Metropolitan Life and Social Studies. And ever since then, she's had the world's most famous case of writer's block. Hasn't written much of anything other than a few articles here or there.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, the problem is she is a born talker, not a born writer.
Yeah.
So I like that we are now moving the narrative away from she's not producing anything to what the fuck is wrong with being good at talking? We live in the podcast mega multiverse right now. Like, there should be more proficient talkers, and she still is one of the greats. I do think you'll find some of her opinions a little trite and outdated, which it makes sense given the fact that she doesn't have a cell phone and doesn't seem to operate even things like a microwave. Like, something about her is deeply, deeply unaware of technology. But she's still fun.
Talking about her writing, the one part that was intriguing to me is, you know, they sort of compare her with Toni Morrison, and where she talks about how, you know, writing is like, she doesn't think that there are any good writers who enjoy writing, because it's always like this miserable exercise. And maybe you've just gotten to the point that she's a speaker,
yeah,
and not a writer. Because when they contrast it with Toni Morrison talking about how she loves to write, you know, I'm like, yeah, and when you read like a Toni Morrison book, like
you can tell,
feel the energy of someone who loves writing, loves her audience, and loves writing for Black people. You know, you can tell when someone is strained by the process of writing, and sometimes it's good, but you know, not everyone wants to read Hemingway.
Totally,
that's true. I will make one small, probably ill-informed comment, but from what I know about Fran, she is a biting humorist, and that is not fun to observe everyone and to be having these like iconoclastic ideas about what they're doing. And not to undercut what Toni Morrison's doing, but I do notice a difference between stand-up comedians and playwrights, like dramatic playwrights, is what I'm saying.
Well, you know, Fran maybe should have a podcast, you know?
She should.
Because people listen to us complain every week.
Right. She does it at double speed, basically.
And she establishes it doesn't make things better, but that's just what we do.
Yes. I was going to say, she made one awesome observation, which is that she did love writing until she was paid to do it.
Exactly.
And I think that's something writers fail to inspect about themselves. Like, why they got into writing in the first place and whether or not being paid for it damages
the love of
the thing that makes you good at it or the thing that keeps you inspired. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I feel like the three of us probably all battle with that right now, being employed as writers.
Right.
You know, it's...
Yeah. During our Shia conversation, I told you about how I went back and looked at like some old like stuff I wrote on the internet when I was like being paid by like the Daily Beast or BuzzFeed to write things. And I look at them and I'm like, child, what were you doing?
Yeah, it's a no.
He was a little content machine, though. You didn't have a choice. I mean, like, you were, you know, it's interesting to me.
It was paying bills. Paying bills and buying drugs. I was going to segue into Pretend It's a City anyway, Lewis, from Aida, talking about
Lebowitz. I knew it. And it was a
funny,
missed opportunity.
Well, funny story. I did not know that Pretend It's a City had come out. Like, I first heard of it because... I saw people tweeting about Lebowitz, and I was like, are they talking about Annie Lebowitz? I sent a text to my roommate, Royce, and asked him, what is going on with Annie Lebowitz on Twitter? And he was like, oh, you're like, you know, she's always doing something. Like, Twitter's talking about her. I was like, okay. And I keep looking. I thought that, like, she had done the Kamala cover. I was like, was I mistaken? It wasn't Tyler. And then I found out it was Fran Lebowitz. And then I told Royce he was an idiot.
I just said this week also that Annie Leibovitz, the photographer, was for years involved with Susan Sontag, the very salty writer. If you want to look up a salty woman, look up interviews with Susan Sontag where she is not putting up with any question whatsoever and rejecting the premise thereof.
I mean, try to read Notes on Camp.
Girl.
There are truly 20 different contradictory things in that essay.
Right. But I will say, this series doesn't get into anything personal about Fran Lebowitz, really. Like, you don't find anything out about her past. And to me, and I said this on Twitter, there is no way she was not romantically involved with Annie Leibovitz at one time. If Annie Leibovitz could date Susan Sontag, there's no way she couldn't date Fran Lebowitz. So I want somebody to get to the bottom of this. I want Martin Scorsese to get into this.
That's why Fran needs a podcast.
Exactly. Right.
Spill it.
But honestly, that's how older lesbian women would get away with, you know, queer marriage laws. Is you would just pick someone who has the same last name as you so you can have a union.
Also, lastly, speaking of older lesbian women, did anyone see that Gail King interview?
Ira.
I am kidding.
Speak on
it. I know that she and Oprah are not lesbian lovers. We've all seen the interview where Oprah said that she is the mother she never had. The sister everyone would want. The friend everyone deserves. It is wild to think about the fact that that quote, which is just a meme on the internet, comes from a time when Oprah sat down for an interview and was asked, are you licking Gail's box, basically. like she was asked, are you in a lesbian relationship with Gail King, your best friend?
And she wrote an impromptu poem about her.
Those are actually on Stedman's cue cards he had for Oprah in the interview. Please lie.
Truly, the one of the least weird things about Oprah is her friendship with Gail.
Right.
People just don't understand friendships.
So Gail did this interview about this girl who, what happened? Like, she robbed somebody and then claimed she didn't? And she also was the dumbest person I've ever heard?
This woman, Maya Ponsetto, who's 22 years old, was basically arrested in Ventura County Thursday after this interview was conducted with Gail via Zoom, but they also had cameras there to sort of catch her. Basically, she thought that her phone was stolen by this 14-year-old black kid. And assaults him and accuses him of taking her phone. It's caught on camera. And then she goes on Gail King and argues with Gail. And it truly was disturbing in so many respects, mostly disturbing because she was dubbed Soho Karen. And I truly hate the word Karen. At this
oh my
point.
God. Mm. If I have to hear it one more time.
Not everyone is a fucking Karen. When they talked about Karens descending on the Capitol, I was like, no. Karens aren't actual terrorists, baby.
Like, yeah, like murderers. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Also, at a certain point, I really want our culture to be aware of like the shelf life of stupid jokes. Like, can we just fucking move on? I'm so tired of it.
Enough, Lewis. Enough. I got my phone back. I've already had my phone returned to me.
Painful. This bitch is out of her fucking mind. I don't have any kind words about it. She's a 22-year-old woman who calls herself a girl and in the same breath calls this 14-year-old black boy that she assaults, allegedly, I think I have to say, but we know what's going on. She calls him a guy. And like this, her lawyer is sitting next to her freaking out. And she's just being a bitch and wearing a hat that says daddy, most importantly. Bitch, what is wrong with you?
I will say I am supportive of these once every 6 months or so Gail King interviews where she basically is an immovable rock. And the person she's interviewing just falls the fuck apart in front of her. You know, like the R. Kelly situation where she just like mutters Robert over and over again and he descends into terror.
Yeah, I like this element of Gail's career and I like the idea that this 22-year-old woman thought bringing her lawyer on TV during her interview was going to help her. And then she ignores the lawyer anyway. And people felt bad for the lawyer. Shaking. But that's what the money's for.
Right. They're not friends. Who cares? Yeah.
I usually have patience for people and I'm empathetic and all that. But this woman needs her whole ass beat. Like, just 3 minutes in a room with Ronda Rousey. No questions asked. Okay. Fuck it up.
On that note, when we're back, we'll be joined by Riz Ahmed.
Quick question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero handholding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
...2020 was a big year for our Emmy-winning guest. Not only did he release his second studio album, The Long Goodbye, he is also getting Oscar buzz for his career-best performance. I will personally say that I think it is, as Ruben in Sound of Metal. Please welcome Riz Ahmed.
Thank you guys for having me.
You are truly such a versatile actor, I want to say. I feel like you can do almost anything. And watching this movie, which is about a drummer who sort of loses his hearing and learns to grapple with that, you play so many different facets of this character, and you really go on like a whole journey, and we're there with you because it's so immersive too. Just the sound design must have been sort of like a dream for the person working on this film too. So can you just tell us a bit about your experience making this film?
Well, thank you so much for the kind words. I mean, I almost don't know where to start because, you know, as implied in your question, there's so many facets to this film. There's the sound design, there's the way in which we shot it, there's the unusual number of deaf actors in this film, there's the fact that the film is subtitled, and of course there's a very long preparation process for a role like this where I learned to play the drums and learned American Sign Language over the course of most of a year. And so there's just so much to it. It's only now that I've finished the film is out there in the world and I have to talk about it to people, that I'm able to almost kind of compartmentalize and see the wood for the trees. But the process of making it was hopefully as immersive as the audience's experiences are watching it. It was one of those kind of crazy experiences where when we finished the film, I turned to the director, Darius, and believe it or not, this is his first film. I turned to him and said, you know, in a way, if no one sees this film, I don't care, because it has just been one of those kind of life-changing growth experiences for me, you know, just taking me to places that I hadn't been before as an actor emotionally, but also in learning those skills and in spending time in those subcultures of the punk scene and the amazing deaf community in New York.
The what happens to this character, how he loses his hearing very dramatically and super quickly. Did you have to seek out people this has happened to in order to learn how this character would have reacted? Because as I was watching you in this movie, I was thinking, I feel like this is how maybe I would react in a similar situation, but it's so unusual that I actually have no idea.
Right. Yes, yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Because it's hard to know how you would react in that situation. And the fact is that people react very differently. There's no one deaf experience or hard of hearing experience. Some people are born deaf. Some people are culturally deaf without having any hearing loss. For example, if you're a child of deaf adults, you may grow up in deaf culture without yourself being biologically, you know, deaf. There are often people who are late deafened, so who won't speak with a deaf accent, for example. because English is their first language. So it's all these different experiences. And in a way, what I learned very quickly is there's no kind of taking a census and working out, you know, what the kind of statistical average is and trying to represent, portray that. It was very much about just trying to lean into the specificity of Ruben as a character. And rather than thinking about what his experiences of hearing loss is not kind of planned for that or control how you might respond to that. It's to kind of try and live in that experience, to live into the character in such a way where you can just be present when that happens. And so I'll give you an example. And I'm realizing very quickly that talking about this film is proving so tricky because it was just a kind of crazy world building process we went on. Let me give you an example. We were like, okay, how am I going to try and respect the reality of hearing loss and catch a glimpse of that? What we decided to do is we got hearing aids and then we flipped them into a white noise setting. And then we customized them to make them really tiny and placed these audio blockers, now I guess you could call them, deep into my ear canal. And they cut out all noise, including the sound of my own voice. And then I gave those controls to the director so that he could, at different moments in different scenes, suddenly just all of a sudden just cut out all my hearing. And so often those moments of shock, surprise, imbalance, disorientation, they're authentic. They're, you know, spontaneously captured. And so we kind of tried to create the conditions where we could really live in the experience. You know, the goodbye scenes are really me and the other actor saying goodbye. They got on a plane, they can't come back to say it after that. Darius, our director, created all these conditions where it just felt as real as possible.
Talking to you right now is still so jarring, especially if Sound of Metal is the first thing that someone has seen you be in, because you as a person is so different than the affect that Ruben has and the personality. Mm-hmm. He's an American punk. Like, it's just so shocking. And I think all great roles do that and all great actors like yourself do that. But I wanted to ask you, playing this character whose whole life dissolves kind of in front of him, his girlfriend leaving and him having to move where he lives, what he's doing, everything changes for Ruben. And while you are acting that role, what does that do for you in your personal life? And how does your own identity change through this characterization?
Thank you, first of all. That's really kind of you. But, you know, it's interesting because I think this role does deal with the question of identity a lot. And that's part of what drew me to it. I think we're living in a time where identity is on the tip of everyone's tongue. And for many good reasons and for other not so good reasons, identity politics is kind of like at the forefront of our culture. And I thought it'd be interesting to play a character who's, as you're saying, his entire identity transforms over the course of 2 hours. You know, he starts off as a blonde punk drummer in a relationship in an RV, ends up as a shaven-headed deaf person in recovery for addiction, not in a relationship, in the middle of Europe, living who knows where. You know, part of what Ruben learns on this journey as a character, and part of what I think I learned in this project, and what I hope a lot of people might take from this role, is that actually our identities are often quite paper thin. You know, even that we think the things that we think are kind of, you know, bedded into who we are, or even our DNA, often the identity we place around that is a social construct. And, you know, Ruben's identity is called into question in the most fundamental way, from as a hearing person to a deaf person. So it certainly made me realize that underneath all these circumstances that we think define us, there's actually this kind of core of humanity that is who we really are. And that transcends black, white, you know, deaf, hearing, tattoos or not. It was interesting to live through that transformation. It changed the way I look up identity and my own identity as well. Mm-hmm.
Speaking about identity in the film too, it starts out with your character Ruben sort of going to this place to deal with his hearing loss. And there's a conversation about how Ruben is not religious, and then the people there, those say that they're in the process of helping people and it's not about converting people. But then the film sort of does have this sort of feel of embracing some sort of higher power, whether that's in religion or within yourself. And I just wonder how you connect with your identity and religion and whether or not this film had some sort of impact on your own thought process?
I love these questions. It's so interesting because the first thing that happens when your identity gets disrupted is your ego gets disrupted, right? Mm-hmm. Your ego is tied to your idea of who you are. And when you disrupt the ego, that's when you kind of create space in your being, in your consciousness, for something bigger than and other than yourself, which I think is what spirituality is connection to something bigger than and other than yourself, you know, to a greater whole, whether that's even a community or an idea or ideals or a divine source. And it's interesting because, you know, it's often in that, in those moments when we're kind of brought to our knees, when we're at our most vulnerable, that we feel that connection to something bigger. I look at it like this. It's like Ruben has this realization that is actually very similar to a realization I've been having during this pandemic. You know, to answer your question, how is some of those themes in the film around spirituality reflecting my own life? This pandemic has taught us the same thing that Ruben learns in the film, which is you don't control anything. We have no control. And we like to think we have so much control. And when you let go of that illusion of control, you realize, well, if I don't control anything, if I don't even control my own body in the way that Ruben does it, you know, or Zed in my other film, Mughal Mowgli, you know, if you don't even control your own body, then maybe everything you have is a gift. You know, maybe I don't control anything. Everything I have has been given to me. And you suddenly move to this kind of like gratitude mentality rather than this entitlement mentality, you know, and I think this can often happen. That's why I say, you know, often people who have the least in society give the most generously. Is when you're really aware of your fragility and your vulnerability, you realize that everything you have is fleeting and it's a gift, and it puts you into that gratitude, that sense of interdependence and connection. So Ruben starts to glimpse that towards the end of the film. And that's certainly something that I feel like I've connected to more over the course of the pandemic, you know? Mm-hmm.
Something that is notable to me about this coming Oscar season, which is already delayed, of course, is that this particular category, Best Actor, is shaping up to be, I think, one of the best years in recent memory. Like, we have your performance, we have Anthony Hopkins in The Father, I don't know if you've seen that yet, or Delroy Lindo in The Five Bloods. And I was wondering, like, have you seen your quote-unquote competition yet? Because if like, I were on the verge of being nominated for an Oscar, I feel like I would be thrilled to see everything else. I think I wouldn't be egotistical about it, but I have no idea. So I was wondering if you have seen, you know, the others in this category yet.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
All these performances that you're kind of speaking about, it feels joyous, man. It feels so joyful to, I don't know, to kind of see people doing amazing work and to see people being encouraged for it and celebrated for it. You know, I'm not as good at kind of receiving praise myself. I know something about the way my brain is wired. I kind of tend to filter that out and, yeah, let's fast forward through that bit. Like, how can I do better? How can I do, you know? And that's often how, actually, I think a lot of people are, you know, I think, and particularly often creative people can be like that. So I'm kind of thinking, you know, in answer to your question, less about that, how does it feel for me? Feels kind of weird, kind of lovely. I'm really glad to see that whatever happens, I'm just glad to see people are shining a light on this film because I believe in it in so many reasons. It's shining a light on lives we don't normally see on screen. But in terms of like other people's work, I kind of feel like I am realizing more and more that creativity is it's a team sport, you know, it's not a solo sport. We all kind of inspire each other. We're all kind of standing on the shoulders of people that went before us. We're all kind of like looking to our sides as we're running this race. We're running it together, not against each other. So I kind of feel just really inspired, you know, right now to see some of this beautiful work, you know, to see what Chadwick Boseman was towards the end of his life, you know, and to hold that and to bring so much of his soul and heart and spirit to that role. See what Anthony Hopkins is able to do, you know, after whatever, 50 years in the game, to still be going to new places, to see an actor like Delroy Lindo, who's kind of just been such a, you know, it's beautiful. You know, Stephen Yeun. I just feel happy to see these awesome artists getting their shine, and I feel inspired by them. And when I feel inspired, I just feel excited. I feel positive about all right, what's next? You know, how can I learn from these people and move forward?
Now you're making me mad because I'm the only one who hasn't seen Minari yet. I need to see that one. I'm excited.
Speaking of great men, I want to congratulate you for being the fourth Muslim actor that Hollywood has allowed in. We had Rami, Hassan, and Kumail, and now you. I mean, and I have this at the forefront of my mind.
Mahershala.
Okay, fine.
Mahershala's got two Oscars. Come on.
But it's not. You're right.
Come on, man.
He's in. No. He's in.
I'm the black Muslim that forgot the black Muslim. That's ridiculous. I wanted to.
Stereotype about how black Muslims are overlooked.
Yeah. But you did a speech in 2017 at the House of Commons about diversity concerning Muslim characters. And then in turn, these two friends, Chef Chowdhury and Dr. Sadia Habib, created a literal test called the Riz test that, you know, is kind of matches the Bechdel test in the way that it concerns itself with the criteria of how Muslims are represented in film and TV, which I actually look to quite often when I am trying to write black Muslim characters, women, men. I mean, even awareness for myself, I think, is important. So I wanted to ask you, what does Muslim representation in films mean to you? And how have you felt like that's improving or maybe worsening over the past few years?
I mean, I guess I'll just say that speech I gave at Parliament in London wasn't so much just about Muslim representation. It was about representation as a concept. And we hadn't even got to that point to get granular. People were still talking about diversity, you know, and this conversation has moved so quickly, it's easy to forget. I was very much against this word diversity. I think diversity feels like an added extra that you, a little garnish that you sprinkle onto your meal, you know, as opposed to the meat and two veg, as we say. Yeah, it's like representation is fundamental to what we, you know, what we expect from our culture and our politics. So that's something that speech was about. And in terms of how Muslims are represented right now, you know, the risk test that you're talking about, I didn't have anything to do with setting that up. But, you know, I support and applaud anyone who's trying to kind of broaden and amplify that conversation. It's interesting, you know, I always think that it works in stages. You sometimes get the stereotype right at the beginning of, you know, any kind of community being, when it starts out being represented, being the corner shop owner, the terrorist, the black drug dealer, East Asian kung fu master, whatever it is. And then you kind of go to stage two, which is, okay, it's taking place on culturally specific terrain, but it's subverting those stereotypes. And some, I've done films like that, like Four Lions or Road to Guantanamo or Reluctant Fundamentalist. Mm-hmm. It's still, you know, shackled to a Muslim conversation and those dominant narratives, but it's trying to challenge them. And then I think ideally you get to a place like playing Rubin or, you know, in Rogue One and all this kind of stuff where you're just a guy. Right? Mm-hmm. You're just a guy and it's not shackled to ethnicity or identity in that way. One thing I would say is I want there to be a fourth stage now, I realize, which is I want to be able to be Muslim and still be just a guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I want to be able to play Rizwan and Akbar and whatever. I want to see a character called Ada, and the specificity of a heritage is part of a character, but it's not really about that. You know, in the same way that, you know, the Gellers in Friends are Jews. But it's not about that. That's all right. You know, it's like whatever. You know,
it's like a throwaway joke. It's like a punchline maybe once ever.
Yeah, whatever. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
You don't have to make a big deal because it isn't one. And so I think that there's always a certain distance to go, but we have undoubtedly made progress since then. You look back to 2017, none of the people, you know, the top five that you put, you know, mentioned there in your rundown, none of them had really come through in that same way, you know, yet. So things are shifting. I am hopeful, but there's always work to be done. And we always got to interrogate our own ideas of what progress looks like, even, you know?
Mm-hmm. I would like to add a fifth stage that's a sci-fi world where Muslims rule. Allahu Akbar. I'm kidding.
The signal's breaking up for some reason at this point.
I would be remiss if I didn't bring up two of my favorite sort of roles that you've done while you're here. I first feel like I saw you in Nightcrawler, which is one of my favorite films of the past decade. I mean,
love it.
Jake is so amazing in it, and Renee is, and then you are. Two, I truly just remember sort of being like, this person with Jake Gyllenhaal is amazing. Who is it? And then later discover, oh, this is Riz Ahmed. And then also, I had forgotten that you were in Girls. And so I rewatched that episode. And, you singing Kanye West's Slow Jam was reminded me that that's one of my favorite sort of comedic performances too. And so I wonder, you know, like, what kind of stuff are you drawn to? Because we've seen you do a lot of comedy, and then we've seen you do some darker stuff like Nightcrawler and Sound of Metal. Although I do want to point out for people listening, Sound of Metal is actually more uplifting than you would think.
It's quite tender.
It took me so long to watch it because I thought that it was going to be some like Darren Aronofsky kind of shit. and I was horrified of actually watching it. But there's that. And then, of course, your music too. You know, I actually really love your album, Long Goodbye. You have the song with Jay Sean on it that I think is fantastic. So, you know, you're just... There's so many things that you could do. What do you enjoy doing?
You know, it's interesting because I think that's one of the questions that I think you continue to ask yourself and to learn new answers to over the course of your career or of your creative life. You know, what do I actually want to do? And you start off thinking, what do I think I should do? Or what do other people think I should do? You know what I mean? What do other people think I should do? And you think, no, what do I think I should do? But of course, you've internalized other people's idea of what you think you should do. And it takes you a while to kind of get through all of that and just kind of follow your own creative curiosity, which is something that I try and follow more now. And particularly, I think, you know, starting out, and it's to Ada's point, talking about there being not too many South Asians or Muslims out there, you know, in this field at different times, feeling a certain kind of responsibility to represent. And now I kind of think less about representing others, more about just presenting myself. And so what I'm drawn to more and more is kind of opportunities to kind of bring all of myself to something. You know, it's weird because I think I grew up kind of code switching a lot between classes and cultures. And that in a way, that's how I started out acting. You're acting every day in different social settings, family and school and whatever it is. That was cool because it allowed me to kind of start acting almost before I even went on stage. But the weird thing is you kind of internalize this idea that you always got to leave part of yourself at the door, you know, before you enter any room. And increasingly what I'm interested in is roles or projects that will allow me to bring all of myself to something. Something like Sound of Metal was just such an immersive emotional role. It wasn't like come play this type or that type, or, you know, I'm coming in to fit in and just be the color blue in this rainbow. I got to bring my whole rainbow to this. You know what I mean? Or, you know, with the music projects, so I released this album, The Long Goodbye, and we created a short film to go with it, which, you know, really pleased to say it's been, you know, kind of become a thing when it's in its own right at the festival circuit. And by this amazing director you guys check out called Anil Karia. And that's an opportunity to bring, you know, my spoken word, my music, acting and my politics and kind of put it all in one place. So I guess what I'm looking for increasingly is an opportunity to not have to, you know, leave part of myself at the door when I enter a project, is to be able to bring all of myself to it.
So maybe we need like a musical from you then.
That's exactly what we need.
Some theater.
Yes.
Some theater.
I want some pizzazz.
Funnily enough, I mean, you know, one of the films that you mentioned, Mughal Mowgli, which isn't out in the US yet, that is kind of a musical. It's kind of a Sufi horror musical comedy. You know, it's like, you know, like you said, it's like you've done this, you've done that. We wanted to create something you can bring it all together. It's definitely something different.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, you mentioning the thing about, you know, what people expect of you too. I think that during the pandemic, a lot of us have been struggling with that. And there was this James Baldwin, Maya Angelou interview going around, which is fantastic. People should watch it. But him talking about, you know, the fact that you failed as an artist once you start trying to do what everyone thinks that you do well, you know?
Yeah, and Maya Angelou saying, when you believe you're on press, you're finished.
Totally.
You're always learning. You always have that imposter syndrome. It's interesting because I was on one of these Zoom calls with Gary Oldman, one of these kind of actor roundtable things recently. And, you know, he's such someone I really look up to. And I put this thing on the table of like, you know, imposter syndrome and how actually is quite common. And he put his hand up and said, I still feel that. I still feel like people about to tap me on the shoulder and be like, we found you out. Can you go home, please? And I think it can be really helpful because it stops you getting complacent, but within limits, you know, particularly those of us who are used to not belonging in certain rooms, we've got to keep that in check. and also alongside that, remind ourselves that now I'm meant to be here. But yeah, that imposter syndrome, that sense of always feeling like you're starting from scratch, it never goes away. You know, every film you come back going, what is acting? What is this? I've been keeping a diary of every week of shooting I've ever done in my life, part of my career, for 15 years now. And it's so funny because I think that if I do that, I'll never have to start from scratch. Dude, you look at the notes I was writing in 2005 and in 2020, it's the same shit. Without exception. You know, you're reminding yourself of the same stuff that you constantly have to learn and relearn. Hopefully it goes a bit deeper each time.
That Gary Oldman has imposter syndrome when he has played Winston Churchill and Beethoven is fucking shocking. I'm glad to hear it.
Before you go, was there anything exciting that you like learned from looking back at your journals that you were surprised that you had written about acting?
I guess the surprising thing is just how the first idea you have is usually the right one. It's not like I thought acting or creativity was this thing, but actually is this thing. No, when you feel the truth of something, you feel it, you know. It was just my ability to articulate it, or even my desire to try and pin it down has changed. I just feel like I was using all kinds of wild metaphors before that just made no sense. And then that kind of starts to refine itself a little bit, and you say, I understand what I'm talking about. But I've kind of realized more and more now, it's like, well, what are you doing by trying to understand this, you know, intellectually? You're trying to control it. You're trying to pin it down. And more, I kind of guess what I'm realizing is like, you know, creativity is about surrender. It's about submission. You know, it's about turning up empty, and putting yourself at the mercy of the process. Yeah, it's interesting how the truth doesn't change. It's just your attempt to try and pin it down and control it. Does.
That's all going in my diary tonight. So thank you, Chris. Everything you just said.
Well, on that note, thank you for being here. Sound of Metal is out now on Amazon Prime, so make sure you check that out.
Question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
I don't know what the fuck was going through our brains Tuesday morning last week when we were recording the show.
Peace.
Thinking about Joe Biden's Electoral College win being certified the next day and not expecting utter chaos.
Right. No,
I didn't even know there was a planned protest. That's how behind I was. I was at such a moment of serenity. I regret it all.
I knew there was a planned protest, but that I couldn't make the logical steps into. Obviously, this is the beginning of like a harebrained, Seussical, raccoon pelt-wearing revolution. I feel bad that I didn't guess further.
Good God. It felt like the 1830s. Like, bum-rushing? Insurrection? Like, does your uncle have cholera? Like, what in the pioneer age shit is going on?
I felt sort of silly not guessing too, mostly just because I was talking to friends, you know, who sort of have family in DC, you know, and they were sort of like, they're getting out. And there's always this idea about violence is obviously going to come from the Trump administration. We've seen it over the past 4 years. We've seen it happening to peaceful protesters during the summer, and that usually came from law enforcement, right? But this was the first time the Clampets hopped in their cars and just trucked on up to the Capitol.
Beep, beep.
Okay.
Beep, beep.
Granny Smith went to Washington.
Oh, is that my Bessie in an insurrection? Beep, beep.
Both chambers of Congress were interrupted by a violent right-wing white nationalist insurrection that left five people dead. And just looking back at these photos, watching it unfold on the news too, was horrifying. I was at the dentist that morning, and I'm getting texts from my roommate about it. Other friends like are like lighting up our text threads, and I like truly did not get the gravity of this until I got back home and turned on the news, and you're seeing that this is still going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think also something that was weird for me was I was sort of seeing images out of order. I saw people approaching the Capitol, then I saw people on the steps, and then weirdly, because it's the Capitol building and they have cameras going all the time, once people were inside, it was weirdly a moment built for television because mm-hmm. you got to see everything really clearly too. And it would be honestly one thing if everybody who stormed the Capitol was like wielding a gun and like bulldozed the police in the way. But what was so crazy to me was the amount of footage of random people just walking around inside. You know, like these people aren't even being stopped. You know, these like strange people just sort of having no idea what to do, walking around. And that's when it got extra eerie for me. Like, who is letting this occur?
Mm-hmm.
How many layers deep does this go? You know? And mm-hmm. so it went from being violent and strange, which we see a lot of violent and strange images anyway, and then it changed to truly twisted and
yeah.
disturbing and so grim. It just was like, they get to win? It was such a question mark.
Yeah.
It can't be understated enough how the 4 years of Trump have sort of given us the idea that, yes, Republicans and right-wing conservatives are evil, but so much of the evil that could be committed is always undercut by the sheer idiocy
right.
of like the people in power,
mm-hmm.
you know? It's like, it makes you horrified for someone else who's smarter than Trump to come along and try and take some sort of advantage of this, because my God, you are staging an insurrection and a coup, and you get to the Capitol building and you swarm it to wander the halls.
Yeah. Like, whatever, footage of somebody hanging out in Nancy Pelosi's office. Did they realize at that moment, oh, yeah, I don't know what Nancy Pelosi does. Like,
yeah.
they just were, like, like, zombified into going there and then not really knowing anything that was happening or what to do or why they were there other than they had to be there because it's a big moment that they were seizing about something. It's just so... It really feels like a robot apocalypse,
yeah.
you know?
Well, there's that group of people, you know, these like knockoff Paul Bunyans that are leaving ransom notes in offices. But then there's that other group of people that came to this coup with the real intention of hurting Congress people.
Yeah.
Whether that was mm-hmm. like, some of them were seen with zip ties. Some of them brought weapons. We know that there were weapons right. there that mm-hmm. weren't owned by the police. Yeah. What were their intentions?
These are former military people too, former law enforcement. And that is sort of also why you have had nary a word from sort of police groups around the U.S. about this, even though a police officer fucking
died,
even though you can see one being like crushed
mm-hmm.
And others being wounded, you would think that they would be feeling real antsy to get out a statement about this. But you can't really do that when it be your own people.
It be your own people, really. Well, here's a thing that frustrated me also was that Maxine Waters said that she was assured by the police chief of the Capitol that everyone was aware of the protest and that the Congress people would not be there at the Capitol. And then suddenly that changed when it was time to count the electoral votes. And that is a red flag for me in the way that if we're supposed to make sure that our congresspeople remain safe, it was like last designated survivor in real life. Like, why were we not taking care of the people who make these important decisions for us?
Mm-hmm. And of course, these people are led there because they are egged on by this fucking rally that Trump has. This nigga's always having a rally.
Right.
Truly, every time I turn on the news, he is standing on some fucking stage yelling at people without teeth. What is happening here? Yeah. Who rallies that much?
He loves the sound of any applause.
It's too much. He should just sell Amway. That's all he wants to do. The scenes of like watching the Capitol Police allow these swarms of people cross the barricades and enter the Capitol grounds was devastating, especially after the summer we just had with Black Lives Matter. Like, we saw cops in tactical gear in like crashing vigils for Elijah McClain with children around.
Yeah.
And then just being like, "La-ti-da, come through to the Capitol and do whatever the fuck you guys want."
Mm-hmm. I was particularly chilled seeing Cori Bush did an interview where she was talking about, well, where she was barricaded inside. And for one thing, I just want to say she really kept her cool in a sort of heroic way. Like, nobody was asking her to keep her cool.
I mean, I fucking love that woman.
Yeah.
And obviously she kept her cool because she's not a quote unquote career politician. She got into politics because she was in the streets of Ferguson being just battered and abused by police. So she's seen this shit before up close.
Yes. Her answering questions and being asked on the air about whether she felt safe with Capitol Police. And like, she had to consider for the first time, like, God, maybe I wasn't. That was incredibly shocking for me to have to watch somebody again. Yeah. Who has fought her way to this place and now has this other question to ask about, like, am I in a new type of danger? It was just horrifying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the danger, of course, comes from Trump inciting this fucking riot. It comes from pieces of shit like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, a name that I just heard of this week, by the way.
Exactly. I should not have to know what that man looks like.
It's just like all these random evil white men who just pop up during these events, like Tom Cotton, when he popped up during the summer. I noticed Tom Cotton wasn't writing any op-eds about sending in the National Guard this week. I wonder why. But all of these people who kept trying to delegitimize the election, keep talking about voter fraud, they are responsible for this. And finally, Twitter did something about it, and they axed Trump's account. And maybe the funniest thing about his account getting suspended was the fact that when he hopped on the POTUS account and tried doing his all-cast tweeting shit again, he was immediately got. It was like when I was pretending to be Beto.
Just immediately, yeah.
Twitter, he was axed immediately. And so he is gone. Mm-hmm. And it is... It's beautiful because it's like, it's yes, we should have gotten rid of Trump from Twitter years ago. But the fact that this cuts off a future revenue stream for him, and all he is a fucking grifter.
Right.
That is the beauty of it. It's harder for him to mobilize. But this, of course, has led to conservatives now saying that they're like Lisa Kudrow in... the Deaf to 2020 thing on Netflix. There's a segment where she's playing a conservative who talks about conservative voices are being silenced. I talked about this on the news. I talked about this on my podcast. I talked about this on Tucker Carlson. Yeah. I talked about it on Tucker Carlson again. every Republican is talking about how, like, now with Parler too, that other social media site with no moderation, and how people are planning to kill congressmen on it. That was removed from by like Apple and Google. Everyone is talking about how they are in danger of losing the First Amendment and being silenced. The funniest to me was Meghan McCain.
Oh, God.
Getting on Twitter. I would be embarrassed to write that shit that she wrote.
It's always some principle they're trying to defend. It's never the person. It's always just, take hers away too.
Do you remember her exact tweet, Lewis?
Well, the tweet I remember most is her saying, "I miss my dad" in the middle of this. Like he would have been some knight in shining armor just anyway. We were supposed to know that. Secondly, by the way, the clips of her on The View recently, Joy Behar is basically holding a flamethrower at this point. Like, why do we even do this? Guys, we have had this moment with Meghan McCain. Please move on.
The screenshot of her when Reverend Warnock was on The View, her just looking angry, which, by the way, so much has fucking happened that we haven't even been able to celebrate the fact that Warnock and Ossoff won.
Yes.
And we took control of the fucking city. But we still have this fucking week to get through. A potential impeachment. Another march towards the inevitable, where we know that we can't expect Republicans to be on the right side of anything. I can't imagine not wanting to hold the people responsible who had you cowering in a fucking corner in the Capitol building. Like, you almost died.
You were in a fire drill.
Back there, business as usual, and you're like, stop the steal. Hawley getting on Twitter talking about how Simon & Schuster canceled his book.
And the whole deal with calling it Orwellian, that his book deal got canceled. It's not Orwellian, it's Owellian. Because books come and go, sweetie.
Took me a second.
I really want to look at all of these people's syllabuses from high school and see if any of them ever were even assigned Orwell. I was assigned Orwell once. It was Animal Farm.
Yeah, I read Animal Farm.
I read Animal Farm. I read 1984 later. But you know what? I'm like, I'm not running around talking about Orwell. Find a new metaphor.
No, that man took one intro to philosophy course and read about fucking libertarian socialism, and that's all he knows.
The nigga went to Yale, Harvard, Yale, okay? He knows that it is not breaking the First Amendment to cancel a fucking book.
Yeah.
That is the thing that we have talked about constantly. People assuming that the right to get a book deal, the right to have a Twitter account is like in the First Amendment. It is not.
Right. Also, the only thing Orwellian about the past 4 years is that we have a true, like, pig god president. So,
Animal Farm came to be. It's some weird mixture of 1984 and Animal Farm.
And so now here we are in a new sort of social media landscape where Trump is not there. And these conservatives are now scrambling for new places to communicate and to plan further violence. And it just feels like we should have seen this coming. And we did see it coming.
Do you feel slightly unnerved that Trump is not on Twitter? I'm not saying I want him there in any capacity, but there is, for me, a bit of an eerie silence to all I'm saying is he's not going to retire gladly. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it makes me wonder what he'll do next.
This is the point in the horror movie where the killer always comes back for one final scare.
That's what I'm, yeah.
We need Neve Campbell up in the White House being like, not in my movie.
God, I love her. That's what we need right now. A bothered woman with terrific bangs.
Well, let's just strap in for whatever this inauguration is going to look like, because I don't know how many more days we have until we can arrest this man, but I patiently wait for that day.
Also want to point out that our schedule for this show, unfortunately, is not in anyone's favor. Last year, we did our episode early so that we could be released on election day, so that we at least wouldn't be guessing about the results. But I don't know. As we record this, they're introducing the articles of impeachment. Next week, we will be recording this the day before the inauguration. So who knows what will be happening as you're listening.
Yeah, maybe we'll have ejected into space. Maybe we'll be in space next week.
Maybe he created Space Force as his final exit plan.
Who knows?
Escaping to the moon.
That would mean he planned ahead, which is more than I would have anticipated for him. So,
the only thing I'm going to worry about after this is just what his kids are going to do, because they can still terrorize us on the internet.
Oh, yeah. Ivanka will be throwing Goya beans at all of us.
Baron, give me your phone. I have to tweet.
All right. When we're back, it's Keep It. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. What a busy week. What a lot of shit week to say Keep It to.
You know who had a busier week? Lori motherfucking Harvey. who is already dating another person. I'm just going to jump into my keep it this week because it's multiple keep its. It's more so about our obsession with Lori Harvey and who she's dating and what the fuck she's doing, as if we even know what this girl does or what her voice even sounds like. But I find us in this annoying position where I know everyone Lori Harvey has dated for the past 3 years, which for some reason is more men than like a 50-year-old divorcee has ever dated. And that's okay. Like, I'm right there with her. She's dated Future. She's dated Diddy. She's dated Diddy's son. She's dated Trey Songz. And now she's dating Michael B. Jordan, which is devastating news for all of the world. And more devastating is these, like, two really creepy, grainy photos they posted on Instagram to, like, reveal to the world that they're together.
I love a relationship reveal.
What? Like, where do y'all find the time? Where do you find to get photos taken? You've been dating for, like, 3 minutes. Two of them you used to get photos taken. But she's an innovator, and I just have to support her hustle because she's ordered the Black Man Hollywood sampler, and I'm excited to see who else she will be dating.
Can you pick that up at Guisado's?
That's right there. Kanye single.
Did you get a pang of joy when Olivia Wilde and Harry Styles revealed their thing?
Are you me? Well, I have this thing where I really believe that this false illusion that I will potentially be with these men one day. So when Harry Styles is now not single, like, that cuts into my life plans. You feel me?
Got it.
So that's frustrating. But
see, that, though, was a more casual celebrity relationship reveal. Mm-hmm. They were just holding hands at a wedding.
In a park.
You know, they knew it was going to get out, but they were like, we're doing something normal. Taking photos and announcing that you're in a relationship in that way is very YouTube influencer.
Quite.
They're too pretty. There was too many teeth in the photo. Like, it was just too beautiful of a reveal. I just don't appreciate it.
The problem with that, and I've been there, is when you announce that you are sort of with someone online publicly that way, do you have to make an announcement when it's over?
Could you imagine?
Potentially.
Because people are going to be assuming, you know?
You just repost the photo with, like, one of the big red no smoking, like, X through the couple's photo. We're done.
It's done. Olivia Wilde is also in that Fran Lebowitz show, which is so weird. She's interviewing her at one part. Anyway, go ahead, Ira.
She's in everything. She's in the Bee Gees doc.
Right. No, she didn't.
Justin Timberlake is for absolutely no reason.
He must have had 36 seconds to film because they don't use any footage of him.
Other than the fact that he played a Gibb brother on SNL for years. That is his only qualification for being in the Bee Gees documentary. But I want to shout out Lori Harvey just for, like, making dry pussies on the internet so mad. The amount of women who are writing, like, there was this tweet from this woman last night, like, I'm 37, you know, and, like, Lori Harvey is younger than me and has been with more men than I've ever been with. And it's like, so...
So she's attractive.
You not getting hit?
And out there.
Is that like, where you're... Yes, she's attractive. It's like, it's a lot of people mad that they only got, like, 12 views on their Bust It challenge. Those are the people who are mad at Lori Harvey dating another man.
I wish I could maintain the roster she has, like the credibility that gives her. She can have anyone now. At this point, that's just high value pussy. So
I think what this truly reveals is two very exciting things. One, Future is basically Dane Cook in that movie, Good Luck, Chuck.
Where everyone
sleeps with him and then finds their perfect match.
Yes.
And two, Steve Harvey's Think Like a Man franchise. What's up with that?
Right.
Because Lori Harvey seems to be doing the exact opposite of everything in those. Or maybe she is thinking like a man.
She really is. She probably studied all that information.
And of course, you know who the number one Lori Harvey of all time is? Wendy Deng, who dated Rupert Murdoch and then Vladimir Putin. That's my favorite. That's the queen bee.
I actually am going to need to leave early so I can go work on a screenplay that's going to be like John Tucker Must Die with Lori Harvey. And we cast all of the men who dated Lori Harvey and their attempts to, like, I don't know, put testosterone in her tea.
Do you think they all are on a group chat feeling sad about it?
I'm sure. Would they exchange all of her, like, really, really rude fuck girl texts? I think so. She said that to me, too.
Harvey's boys.
There you go.
Anyway.
There's like a next bus where they're all hanging out.
Yeah. Lewis, what's your keep it this week?
My keep it is, of course, tentative because it's a casting decision. But I have to say, I have tried to wrap my head around this and just it makes no sense whatsoever. Guys, Nicole Kidman is playing Lucille Ball.
Oh.
What? First of all, let's think about the dimensions of Lucille Ball. She ain't 6'1" an Australian to start. Second of all, Javier Bardem is playing Desi Arnaz. Wrong? What do they have in common? That's a completely bizarre casting choice. I remember years ago, this Aaron Sorkin production was announced years and years ago, probably 5 or 6 years ago, and it was supposed to be Cate Blanchett.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard a rumor that it was going to be Oscar Isaac, which felt a little closer to me. But now, Cate Blanchett is kind of the master of like 50s vocal cadences. So I sort of saw it for her. Like she could do the wide eyes and the Vitamita Vegemin bits and then do really intimidating boardroom Lucy, which is what I suspect this movie is really about. The way that the movie is structured, apparently, it's about a week of shooting on I Love Lucy where something occurs and she and Desi's careers are put into jeopardy throughout the week. All I can say is, one, we definitely need a Lucille Ball movie. It's really weird to me that this is a woman who co-owned Desilu Productions. She was a maven. She also had years and years before I Love Lucy where she made the worst fucking movies. Again, nothing was pointing at this woman being a legend for years and years. So I'm interested to see how they explore this, but my God, it just feels like so many other people would be better suited to play Lucille Ball. The first person that comes to mind who I think could do the comedy if it is in the script and then the boardroom part would be Charlize Theron. But and the reason I'm pulling back from that is we already gave her Bombshell. And guys, what was that movie? I'm still mad at that movie, whatever the fuck that was.
You just need someone who can do a good Ricky.
Yeah, it has to be. Yeah, you have to get to the like the relatable core of her comedy, which remains sort of hilarious. Like if you watch the show, like it holds up, you know, in a way. Mm-hmm. Kind of like how Ira and I talked about how the thing that is most timeless about Gone with the Wind is Mammy's comedy. Like that kind of like, not this again, you know, like that stuff mm-hmm. is still funny.
I Love Lucy was one of my favorite shows as a kid. From the era of Nick at Night TV Land.
Yeah,
totally.
So are you, Lewis? And it was on all the fucking time. And so I have seen every episode of
Total,
I Love
there's
Lucy.
No way I haven't like, seen every episode.
So
there's
many
no
times.
Way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you see them more than once, which is intriguing because we've probably seen them more than people who were alive while it was actually airing. Because
totally.
They didn't rerun that show that fucking much as right. they did in the 90s when we were kids,
mm-hmm.
Including the ones where she's out in California.
That's the best.
And then the color episodes. I fucking love Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
I like Sorkin. I'm more okay with Nicole doing this just because she could maybe be fine with a big character like Lucy, but I don't know. The thing that gives me pause is Sorkin directing it.
Right.
I thought we established we don't need that.
Trial of the Chicago 7 did not give me life. And additionally, maybe I should be thankful because you know who is a more intuitive choice and has worked with Sorkin before? Jessica Chastain.
Ooh.
Who's like exactly the age, too.
Yeah.
Is she funny?
Wouldn't have served comedy for me.
In The Help, she was funny, but that was broad in a different way. So I don't know if she could do this.
It's funny how she always talks about how she's doing roles that are strong for women and then does Molly's Game. So
that movie, deeply long.
You know, I liked Trial of Chicago 7. We've talked about this on the show. But I like that because it fits into the sweet spot of all the things that Aaron Sorkin is obsessed with. I don't need a Lucy movie that ends with her giving a very long speech about comedy and the human condition.
Oh, yeah. You never know. We might be getting that.
Yeah.
Who's playing Vivian Vance? Anyway.
I wish there was a stand-up comedian or someone like a comedic actress that could, if I could combine Sarah Silverman and like Chelsea Handler. If I could make these people, if I could make the right person to play this, but I don't think that's the right choice. I do remember reading about Deborah Messing wanting to play this role, and I think she's closer even. Than...
Wishful thinking. She's a dreamer. She dreams a lot in her sleep.
I believe right now Deborah Messing is still retweeting people saying she should have been cast, and it has...
Let her live.
I'm Nikki Blonsky from the movie Hairspray energy, if you know what I'm saying.
Oh, my God.
Well, what else is Deborah Messing going to do right now? Because she is in the class of people who I've been especially worried about from Trump leaving Twitter, by the way. Mm. It is, what do the people who spent all day camped out in his mentions responding in earnest to his tweets, what are they doing with their lives today?
Right. I don't. They have to dunk on their loved ones. That's it.
I don't understand the emotion of rage. I don't understand it. Sustained rage? Ew. Find something else to do.
All right, Ira, what's your keep it?
I have two keep it's this week. One of them's brief. The first one is, why is Andrew Yang running for mayor of New York City?
Yeah, I'm not into that.
I didn't know that when you fail at becoming president, that you just pick an American city and decide to become mayor, because he does not even live full time in New York. And then his quote where he says, we live in a 2-bedroom apartment in Manhattan. Can you imagine trying to have 2 kids on virtual school in a 2-bedroom apartment and then trying to do work yourself, sir?
Can you imagine?
Who is voting for you when you talk like one of the people the New York Times interviewed at the beginning of the pandemic, who talked about how they fled to the Hamptons because they couldn't stand being in their cramped apartment?
Yeah, that's tough. That was a very self-sabotaging quote in a rare way.
So looks like I won't have to worry about Andrew Yang becoming mayor of New York after all. Anyway, my real keep it this week is to the entire conversation surrounding Sex and the City's reboot.
Ooh, okay.
And just like that is what it's called for some reason. I think that's cute. That's a cute title, actually.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Basically, the conversation, though, stems from the fact that Samantha will not be in this reboot. Kim Cattrall will not be involved.
Therefore, rendering it unwatchable.
Yes. They sort of announced this recently before we saw a little teaser that was released and narrated by Sarah Jessica Parker. They announced it right after Filthy Rich was canceled too, which I feel like was an extra little dig. At Kim Cattrall. But there's people on one side of the camp who are like, the show will be fine without Samantha. And then there's other people who are just sort of like, there'll be no sex in the city. And I feel like I am sort of that ilk. You know, it's just like the entire show for me was about these four women navigating sex. And Samantha was the fun one who like had a lot more sex than everyone else, you know? And it's just sort of like, are you going to introduce a new woman into the group to get that? And I think that at some point, stories should be finite. You know,
yes.
I say this as a person who still watches Days of Our Lives, and that is never going to end. But we've seen her with Big. We've seen Sex and the City 2, which was an unmitigated disaster.
Shocking.
One of the most racist films that doesn't have Mickey Rooney in yellow face.
Right. The U.S. has still not patched up its relationship with the UAE from that movie. I believe it's still strained.
I don't think we need it, you know, and it's not stemming from the fact that, you know, it's a story about older women and their bodies and sexuality. And, you know, because like I see some people complaining that like they're too old. What are we going to be watching? That's not my problem with it. My problem is just that since Sex and the City left, there have been a lot of knockoffs, Lipstick Jungle, Cashmere Mafia. And people try to say that like, Insecure, Girlfriends are sort of like Sex and the City, but they're not really. We really have not had TV shows with non-white women who are privileged dealing with sex in a fun, interesting way that Sex and the City did, mm-hmm. You know? like those had wild sex scenes on them.
Right. Yeah.
And they were always funny. And I feel like we don't get that, you know, like we don't see it in black shows.
Mm-mm. One thing I will say is we weirdly have had a test bubble with which to appreciate Sex and the City without Samantha, which is E's reruns, which it, where Samantha's largely cut out because her scenes are too risque full of profanity or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's not like I love those episodes, really. I do still watch them. Honestly, my thing is, I think you could just do a Miranda show. I think she's a little bit of like just a more interesting character. Someone you could do a lot with in her 50s, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm cautiously optimistic. I do think these are three of the best performances on TV in the past 20 years. So I'm excited to get those ladies back. But you're right. Like if it's even slightly bad, we're just going to feel like shit.
I mean, speaking of Deborah Messing, it's sort of like when Willa Grace came back, right? And we were like, okay.
Yeah.
It's here. Mm-hmm. But like it introducing nothing really to the cultural conversation. I'm just thinking about the old series.
Yeah. It just sort of immediately stalled and we were fine with it for 2 years or whatever.
Yeah. Plus, there's a series like this that feels like such a time capsule of when it was. And I do worry about efforts that might happen to fix that. Like it's diversity. I'm like, I don't want to see this show trying to tackle that. I just feel like let things live in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of the X-Files reboot, which came back and then tried to like be a bit more woke. But it was still the same white men writing it from the 90s. And they were decidedly very not in tune with culture as it is now, or even existing as a human being, because if you wrote on the X-Files in the 90s on Fox, you're probably insanely wealthy and you've never interacted with a human being again since 1999. I'm just worried about that respect of it, like trying to fix the problems of Sex and the City that people have commented on in the present. And I still don't think the show knows that Carrie Bradshaw was an anti-hero, as Emily Nussbaum said in her great essay, Difficult Women. It undercuts that a bit mm-hmm. in the finale and tries to give her the perfect happy ever after. So I don't know. I have a lot of feelings, but whatever. So that's our show this week. Thanks again to Riz Ahmed for joining us. And we will see you next week. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Caroline Reston, and Brian Semmel is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Ira Madison III. I think I've heard of him. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Melkonian, and Milo Kim for production support every week. Stay safe. Be blessed. God loves you.
Quick question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero handholding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.